No, I podcast. This is a recording. This is Mulholland Drive.
Side saddle.
Bareback.
The cowboy of podcasters.
Oh,
giddy up.
Speaking of cowboys.
Welcome to Seen and Heard. This is the podcast where two entertainment assistants go through the Sight and Sound Top 100 Greatest Films of All Time list. I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
And we're joined today by two very special guests.
Oh my God.
Very special. No. Very, very, very special.
Oh dear.
Extremely. Oh my.
This episode will be longer than usual because there are four of us in the room today.
What?
To take on this beast of a movie. We have Victoria Harley and Chelsea Pope from the Breath of Fresh Movie podcast in the studio.
What? Hi, this is Victoria.
Hi, I'm Chelsea.
Thank you so much for having us. We're sharing a mic, so there may be delays between our responses.
We're like the Ronettes, or we're like
the girls in the movie who are sharing.
Yeah,
exactly.
We're just gonna get exactly.
Sylvia North, eat your heart out.
16 reasons.
It was intentional.
Yeah,
there you go.
Tell us about your show, you guys.
Oh my God, thank you for that opening. We host a weekly film podcast where each week we watch a movie neither one of us has ever seen before, and then we talk about it. And it's with humor.
I was going to be like, we may not talk about everything, but we'll talk about anything. Ting, ting, spoilers ahoy. That's just our spiel, because that's what we say before every...
Spoilers are ahoy here as well.
Yes.
Here as well?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yes. You emailed about merch recently, I think, regarding Spoilers Ahoy.
Oh, I did. Yeah, yeah.
You guys should do that.
High praise.
It's because you called it out. You were like, you should trademark that. I'm like, well, I don't know.
We're thinking this. So
we're working on it. Good. Working on a Chips Ahoy kind of look.
We'll see.
Yeah, like a parody.
But no, thank you so much. I mean, I'm a huge fan of your podcast as well. Like, I think it's, you know, been really fun getting to know you guys both, like, through the air and in person.
Likewise.
So thank you so much for having us in your home.
No, it's really nice. To connect with just other film fans in the community, and also just like in the literal physical vicinity of LA, and you know, here you and Victoria going to see the Heartbreak Kid last night.
I didn't even know.
But it's cool. It's like, okay, like it's just nice to making friends. You know,
it's great.
Making friends is hard, you guys.
It is. Like, as an adult, it's hard.
It's definitely hard.
That's why we have cats.
Yeah,
exactly.
So Greg and I recently went on Breath of Fresh Movie to discuss the French Lieutenant's Woman.
And you are lovely. Very fun.
Feel free to check out that.
It was super fun. Feel free to check out that episode. It's great.
And I saw, because this will be airing on a Tuesday. Monday, you guys dropped. So yesterday, you guys have an episode on Beau Is Afraid, right?
It's coming up this week.
Right.
Yes.
Monday.
So by the time you hear this, it'll be out now. So go check it out.
You guys saw it already?
We did.
We did, yeah.
Ooh, we'll have to wait and see what you think.
Did you see it yet?
I didn't see it yet.
All right.
I've been super
no spoilers.
I saw it.
No spoilers. Nobody. Yeah. Nobody.
You'll have to wait.
You guys but you should see it. You should see
it. I'm going to. Yeah. Definitely. So this is a great transition into what else have you guys been watching?
That's not Mulholland Drive.
And not Beau Is Afraid.
Oh, well, Succession, for sure.
It's like about to end, right?
It is. Yeah. It's about to end, you guys. Oh, man. What's going to happen?
He died, right?
Oh, shit. Spoiler. Ding, ding, ding. Spoilers. Somebody died. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, yeah, the whole internet, like, fucking blew up when that happened. Like, the LA Times article that Victoria and I were kind of bitching about that.
I was very annoyed about that.
That was a little tacky.
Just a little too soon.
It was a little much, I think.
Also, I was like, what? Okay, you're trying to tell us that you guys like Succession. I got it. All right, great.
Art imitating life, imitating art things. I don't know. But yeah, it's been watching that, and it's a lot of YouTube, I guess. Like YouTube. I rewatched a Super Nintendo 64 Super Mario gameplay.
Like a speed run or something?
Yeah, dude. Yeah. They know... I didn't know that Mario could parkour. And apparently you can fucking get Bowser down and eat that peach cake in like 45 minutes if you really want.
Wow.
If you really want. Anyway, that's Your turn.
Oh, my turn. Okay. Man, I'm trying to think of what I've been. I haven't been watching many movies. I mean, similar. I'm usually on that. I'm usually like, screw TV. I watch movies. But lately, no. I've seen this documentary like more than once before, but I've just been rewatching Wild Wild Country.
Oh, so good.
It's been like a weird comfort watch in a weird way. The music is so good. That's what I realized is the soundtrack is what's carrying me through. So that, and of course The Heartbreak Kid, which was just a treat. I don't like want to just be that person who's like, it was so good. No, you weren't there.
The theater or any of the other stuff you guys.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good crowd.
Great crowd. A lot of people. I was also there.
Yes, you were also there.
It was so good.
Yeah, I mean, it's like any comedy in a crowd. It's just the best. I mean, certain lines just hit, certain shots really just it was just a great night. Great night of comedy.
I agree, and I feel like there aren't really comedies nowadays, right?
Yeah.
Not that many.
Am I wrong? Like, when was the last time you guys went to a movie that was like a straight comedy?
For real.
That was good.
Like, that's
that new. Was good. Yeah. That's a great question. Keyword. Actually, I cannot.
It seems.
Immediately remember.
Yeah, it seems.
Like, Banshees of Inisherin was funny.
I mean, it was funny, but that's not a. No. It's not Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which that has a sad ending. But
yeah. It's true. Bittersweet.
Oh my God.
Actually, no, it's pretty sad.
It ruins me every time.
It's sad.
Yeah, I really can't think of one.
What have you guys been watching?
Yeah.
Well, I saw The Heartbreak Kid.
Was it your first time seeing it?
No, it was my second, but the first time was on YouTube, which seemed to be the consensus of most people there, which
where
was so funny.
Where else can
you
find it?
You
nowhere.
Can't.
Yeah.
It's nowhere.
Yeah,
I've never seen it.
It's so strange.
Recommend.
So good. Like, it's so funny and also really dark, but not at all in an obvious way. I love it. It's incredible. Yeah. I look forward to the day when more people can see it. I don't understand
Agreed.
Why it's like this.
Because Bristol Myers Squibb owns the rights through this weird acquisition thing, and somebody needs to go negotiate with them, like
Criterion.
with like one of the one of the guys in Mulholland Drive who's in those meetings. That's what we need.
Why the mobsters?
Yeah, like the guy who lets the espresso just fall out of his mouth.
Oh yeah,
we have mobsters in LA. Like, where are you guys?
Yeah,
like, what are you doing?
Movie mobsters. That work for the rights of movies.
Yeah, yeah. Really that's a like, thing. They're called studio heads.
Yeah, that's true. Actually.
Just get your priorities straight, you guys.
I also finally watched Breaking Dawn Part 1 and Part 2.
Legit.
Such a weird relationship with Twilight. When I was in high school, for a minute, I was really obsessed with it. I read all the books. I was really into the movies. But then when the third movie came out, I was just like, this is actual garbage. And I was also really into Harry Potter. And so people were doing this weird thing where it was like, if you liked one, you couldn't like the other. And I was like, well, I'm picking Harry Potter, obviously.
It's like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. Right. But they have nothing in common.
Yeah.
So I ignored Twilight for a really long time. I dismissed it, that it's just silly nonsense, which is mostly true. But then now I've come to realize that's what makes it so fun and so great. And
it's
having
a renaissance.
I've had such a good time rewatching these movies, but I had never seen Breaking Dawn, either of them.
That's shocking.
I know. And so, what a treat. Have you guys seen them? Breaking Dawn Part 1 and Part 2?
Yeah.
I've only seen the first Twilight movie.
Same.
Oh, really?
But I got to say that...
I mean, you get it.
It's camp.
I do think Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson's image have totally changed for me in the ensuing years.
Incredible how much they've changed.
Yeah.
Just they've always been that way, but they just like revealed themselves.
They just their career choices, their booking choices, just fully reactive to wanting to distance themselves from that franchise as much as possible.
Exactly.
Which is funny because it's almost like time did a little bit of service. Yeah, it rejuvenated the franchise in a way.
I mean, it's still ridiculous. Don't get
it's me still
wrong.
Ridiculous,
like,
but then we
so ridiculous.
It
but
can
now
get
we
so
like
much
it.
Worse. Is the thing I think in the sense
can
it's
it
like
get worse. Renesmee,
yes,
it can always get worse.
Yes, it can always.
But then you know you got like 50 Shades of Grey, which is a fanfic based on a fanfic, which is like
right.
It's kind of the copy of a copy of a copy
That's
thing
true.
And then you're like maybe Twilight isn't that bad in comparison to how many deviations we can go down
exactly.
I guess but
it's like Nixon
you're not
wasn't
wrong.
So bad.
You were so not wrong.
yeah
yeah
so yeah that's what I've been watching
tight
nice I My favorite one that I saw in the last week was a film called Queen of Diamonds by Nina Menkes from 1991.
Is that the one, the gambling one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I've seen that.
Oh, incredible. Really blew me away. Saw that. I saw a movie called The Wild Boys by Bertrand Mandico, who his big film last year was like After Paradise or something, which I have not seen yet. I got to see On Her Majesty's Secret Service at the Arrow, which is like the second time I've been to the Arrow in the 10 years I've lived here because it's so far.
Yeah.
George Lazenby was supposed to be there, but he got sick or something. He couldn't come. And then
sure.
I did see the new Evil Dead movie, Evil Dead Rises.
Oh, yeah.
Have you guys seen it?
Not yet.
I was disappointed because the buzz around it is good. I mean,
people are really hyping it.
It's
online.
Like perfectly fine. Yeah. I think it's just like someone wrote like a really by the numbers like possession movie, and then Sam Raimi was like, "Oh wait, we can like make that an Evil Dead movie. Let's just let's put the name on it and add a couple things from the series, and boom, you got an Evil Dead movie." And that's what it felt like.
It feels like that with a lot of like franchise sequel, like the Paranormal Activity movies feel a lot like that. Is the further down you go, it's kind of like, oh, we're just kind of shoehorning it. Like if we add this, we stamp it with the known name, then that'll guarantee some numbers or something.
Exactly, yeah.
Because it does seem very, from the previews I've seen, so disconnected. And this also like 10 years after I liked the reboot, you know.
Right.
I liked the 2014?
2013, 2014, something like that.
One of those, That was really solid. And then this feels very...
Yeah, and just like to me, Evil Dead is like Bruce Campbell or Sam Raimi's like kinetic energy, and when you lose both of those things, it's like it's not Evil Dead then. Or like, but I also liked the remake from like 10 years
ago. It's like you better stick the landing if you're going to make a hard left from the charm, I guess, if you will, of that. Yeah.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
kinetic. That's a great word to describe that.
Yeah, because that's like the whole charm of those movies.
Oh, yeah. The way Bruce Campbell like had to go work out like to get that buff and just did it totally for the movie and not for the magazines or any of that BS.
Yeah.
Bruce Campbell's like the greatest, like most game actor.
He's so game.
He's so game.
Yeah, and it's like he's still young-ish and like
he's
just
the
did,
best,
he did the TV series, and so I'm like, why didn't we just make this Bruce Campbell starring Evil Dead?
We should put Bruce Campbell on our money. I think
so too. He is a national treasure. Anyway, since we have four Angelinos here, I think it's appropriate for this week's film,
which is number
do you know?
Yeah, I know. 28 in 2012, and number 8 in 2022, which we'll talk about.
So moved up.
Yeah.
I know Mulholland Drive, by the way.
Mulholland Drive.
I don't know if we've even mentioned it.
Yeah.
Except the beginning. Mulholland Drive.
That's good.
Yeah. Oh, right. I have to properly
interesting
intro.
Where it moved. Yeah.
Continue. No.
No, we'll talk about it for sure.
Yeah. It is quite the jump.
Yeah.
To be in that top 10 is something.
I think rightly. Maybe, I mean, I know there's a lot of movies, but I don't know. Having just come off it again today, I was like, this is pretty excellent. It's pretty great.
Yeah, I think it's his best. And, you know,
let's save this. Let's save this for initial thoughts.
From 2001, this is David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive was released in 2001. It was written and directed by David Lynch, cinematography by Peter Deming, music by Angelo Badalamenti. Wide-eyed, aspiring actress Betty Elms arrives in Los Angeles to pursue her dreams. She's staying at the apartment of her aunt, who is out of town shooting a movie. She discovers a woman in the apartment who is suffering from amnesia after a car accident on Mulholland Drive. The woman calls herself Rita after spotting a poster for the 1946 film Gilda, starring Rita Hayworth. Her purse has thousands of dollars of cash in it and a strange blue key. Meanwhile, film director Adam Kesher discovers his wife is having an affair with the pool man and is pressured by mobsters to cast their choice of actress, Camilla Rhodes, in his new picture. Betty and Rita set out to solve the mystery of who Rita is. The name Diane Selwyn comes to Rita's mind, and they visit her listed address. In Diane's apartment, they find a dead body on the bed. That night, Betty and Rita make passionate love, only to leave the house at 4 a.m. to attend a show at Club Silencio. After the show, Betty discovers a blue cube in her purse. When Rita unlocks the cube with the key she found in her purse, it falls to the ground. The film then takes a shift. Betty is now Diane Selwyn, living in the same apartment Betty and Rita previously visited. She and Camilla Rhodes, an actress and the former Rita, have just broken up, and Camilla is now in a relationship with Adam, who is directing a film both of the women are appearing in. Diane hires a hitman to kill Camilla, and he tells her when the deed is done, she will find a blue key in her house. The film ends with Diane shooting herself while being harassed by images of an old couple Betty met on a plane over to the City of Angels. The film stars Naomi Watts as Betty Elms / Diane Selwyn, Laura Herring as Rita / Camilla Rhodes, Justin Theroux as Adam Kesher, also starring Ann Miller as the apartment manager Coco, and Robert Forster as a detective in one scene.
Don't forget about Dan Hedaya.
I love him as well. Dan Hedaya as a mobster. Did you guys know that Laura Herring was the first Hispanic woman to be crowned Miss USA in 1985?
No, I didn't know that.
And
no
she's,
idea.
I she married a German count.
Oh.
And she's actually a countess.
Oh,
girl,
wow.
Crazy, right?
Get I did life. Not know that.
The film was originally an open-ended pilot for ABC, but upon viewing a rough cut, the studio decided against it.
Which is insane.
The pilot ends as they discover the body in Diane's apartment. Then, Studio Canal came in and decided to fund the project as a feature, and Mulholland Drive became an American-French co-production. 20 months had passed since the initial shoot, and they had to pick up where they left off, recreating sets and props. The film was shot in Los Angeles. Aunt Ruth's apartment building is in Hancock Park. Diane's apartment is on Griffith Park Boulevard in a complex known as the Snow White Cottages. They're located just a few blocks from the original Disney studios and are said to have inspired the animators of the 1937 film Snow White and the Seven Dwarves.
Which one's that?
There are 8 cottages, so it's the perfect dwelling for Snow White and her men. They allegedly served as office space for the animators while making the film.
That's so LA.
I know. The Palace Theater is Club Silencio. Pink's Hot Dogs makes an appearance. And Caesar's is the name of the diner that turns into Winkies. It was located in Gardenia. Now it's closed. David Lynch apparently refused to give even his cast an explanation about the unsolved mystery of the film, but he did make it clear to Justin Theroux that he was not a reflection of himself. That was like the one thing he clarified. Yeah. Like, you are not playing me. The film premiered at Cannes in 2001. Lynch won Best Director, sharing the prize with Joel Coen for The Man Who Wasn't There. Lynch was also nominated for an Academy Award for Best Director, and this was Ann Miller's last movie. It was named the best film of the decade by Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Cahiers du Cinéma, IndieWire, The Village Voice, Time Out New York, and Slant Magazine. Those are my specs. You have more. I see you.
I just have a couple.
Go ahead.
I have a couple. So the stuff that was shot for the pilot basically leads up to when they first sleep together. That stuff is all pilot stuff. And then obviously it gets very, very R-rated, which was shot the 20 months later. And then the whole last section of the movie where the camera goes into the box obviously was not filmed for the pilot. But I think everything else, more or less before that, I think was for the pilot.
Mm. It's on YouTube.
Man, I really had no idea about any of this. So that's like really? Yeah. I mean, I know some things about David Lynch, but I didn't realize this was like initially a pilot for a show.
It's weird, right?
I know too. According to Sherilyn Fenn, this was intended originally to be an Audrey Horne spinoff from Twin Peaks. So the Naomi Watts character was supposed to be Audrey. That's what she says, at least.
Interesting. Because I have heard that, and I think it's like an Easter eggy thing, but in Club Silencio, I think Bronette Pulaski is supposed to be seated in like the corner. So I think like there's some kind of connection to the Laura Palmer thing, and certainly mm-hmm. there's lots of other shit to tie it in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. Hot take. I think it's better that it's a movie. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you know, he ran into that problem as well. It's interesting that he would want to go back to television or attempt to after the situation with Twin Peaks, where mm-hmm. he had to kind of relinquish control of the narrative with that. And, you know, season two went where it went. It's like, well, but just sort of how I can understand the premise with Twin Peaks of it being an ongoing sort of, don't get caught, like you're missing the forest for the trees if you're getting too caught up in the murder mystery. Like it's more about the Twin Peaks itself, and it's like, but in this case it feels so personal to Betty/Diane that it's hard for me to imagine it not. I don't know how you would sustain this beyond maybe like a mini series. I don't know,
right?
Not that I wouldn't be compelled to watch it, but just mm-hmm. I like that part of what I think makes this such a strong feature for him is that it is one of his more concise works. And yes, there is like lots of room for interpretation. I have my views on it, but I like that there is something definitive about mm-hmm. it.
I agree.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I can't help. I agree with you. I think it works great as a film, I guess, right before we get into initial thoughts, but I am like sad. Like I would have loved to have seen the series.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because I am such a Peaks head.
What direction could that have gone, you know?
Like, yeah, I don't know. He just knows how to when he had control over Twin Peaks, like the draw of the mystery and stuff was just so hypnotic.
Yeah.
And then too, like, has anyone seen his follow-up to Twin Peaks on the air? Most people don't know he had another show. It only ran for like 6 episodes. It's a slapstick comedy about these people running a radio station. You know the guy from Twin Peaks that plays Richard Tremaine, the guy that like romances Lucy, who kind of seems like from another era?
Yeah, I hated that guy.
He's like the lead. He's the lead in that show. So
it's
maybe
like an
don't watch
joke.
It.
You're not in on it. No, that's fun.
Yeah, no more, please. Yeah. I'm good.
Well, okay, let's do initial thoughts. But as you know, this film is like you just said, Chelsea, like this is such this is Lynch's most popular movie. It's his most accessible movie.
Yeah.
And because of it, a lot of people have seen this movie that maybe this is their only David Lynch movie because it's pretty mainstream and has been since it came out. But like, let's talk a little bit because there is no definitive explanation of like this is what happens in the movie. There are lots of people who think different things, including the cast and crew. So let's just go around and talk about first impressions, first time you saw it. I guess maybe talk a little bit about what the movie means to you, and we'll just kind of go around in a circle.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
You want to start?
Okay, sure.
Lead the way.
I'm gonna save some of this for our Blue Velvet episode, which is upcoming. But David Lynch, I mean, like any...
man,
like, yeah, sure, any like white boy with glasses, like David Lynch is one of my heroes, and you know, his movies are deeply, you know, that's a part of the reason I wanted to make movies in the first place. And I remember the first time I saw this, I was in high school. The movie was a couple years old at that point. I think I probably saw this in 2003, so it was just a couple years old. And I remember a friend of mine, I was just getting into David Lynch. I had just seen like Blue Velvet and Eraserhead, and my friend was like, oh, you got to see this movie Mulholland Drive. I was like, oh, that's a David Lynch movie. Okay, yeah, I'll see that. And I remember my friend telling me, he's like, I've seen it 10 times because I'm trying to figure out what it means. And he like showed me all these notes he had of like, it's funny because... he wasn't like a big like film guy, but this movie like had a spell on him, which I think again is why it remains so famous. But so I immediately went out and saw it and I loved it. And I think what works so well about this movie is it is this middle ground of, it's like a mostly straightforward film and it's a really compelling mystery. And I think the David Lynch touches are more palatable in this film than some of his other movies. Even his like kind of warm up for this, which was Lost Highway, I feel like is such a lesser accessible film. Like that one's...
That's a hard watch.
It's a hard one. I didn't like that one the first time I saw it. Maybe the first two times I saw it. But yeah, so I think this film rightfully, you know, is like on the top 10 now. You know what, though? It's not my favorite David Lynch movie, so I would not put it on the top 10. I think it has a place on the top 100.
Which one would you be?
It's the Twin Peaks movie. It's Fire Walk With Me.
Cool.
I think too, similar to this, like the Laura Palmer character is so fully drawn in that film. And Sherilyn Fenn, Cheryl Lee, gives such an incredible performance. And it's such a cathartic piece of cinema. I think Naomi Watts does something similar there here, but I don't think it quite reaches the emotional heights of Fire Walk With Me. So that one's my favorite. I think I also like Blue Velvet more than this. Maybe this, I think I might even like Eraserhead more than this. But I like love those movies. Like those are all like 5 out of 5s for me. This one's like a 4.5 slash, this is almost a 5. Anyway, who cares about numbers? It's a great movie. I love this movie. I think, look, I don't read a lot into David Lynch films, and it's not who I am as a person. It's funny because doing this podcast with Jackie, she wants to get in there, get her hands dirty, pick everything apart, which is fun. But like, it's not my go-to mode. Like, I always feel a movie first, even if I don't quite understand it. I'm just like, okay, well, I get what I'm supposed to feel, or I feel this is my response to it. So I don't have some big, like, this means this and this connects to this. I know one of the bigger theories out there is that it's all a dream. Like, she is the Diane character living this really depressed life. She kills herself, and all of this sort of like conjures up in her head in her dying moments, like the part, you know, the first 2/3 of the movie. I think that sounds pretty good. I've also heard a theory that they're like alternate universes that kind of cross into each other a little bit, and I'm cool with that too. But David Lynch, yeah, he specifically, you know, he does not ever vocalize what his films mean, because honestly, my take, I don't think he has like a through line necessarily. I think he comes from, you know, he's big on meditation, and I think he's just like impulsive. And like, I have the scene about it in my head of a guy sitting on a chair and a woman comes in and this, and then I think he just does it. And it's like, so I don't necessarily think there's like a through line. That's just my take. But I just love the feel of this movie. It was, as a person that lives in LA and loves Hollywood history and the sort of creepiness, like Hollywood is superficial and magical, but it's also nightmarish. And what a great film that sort of capture all the different parts of Hollywood. So yeah, I love the movie.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree with like all of that. Yeah.
Victoria, yeah.
Oh my God, it's my turn? Yeah. All right. So as I turn the mic toward me, I'll know. I mean, no, I'm with you. This movie, like, I've seen it a number of times, but I think this time, like more than ever, I felt like it really felt elegiac. Like this is all about like the dark power that craves young blood. And wow. I really feel like this, like the darkness, the underbelly of this world, it's so gestural. Like we just see, you know, powerful people behind glass or curtains. We don't, single words uttered over phone lines. You get such a sense of the power and where that these people have unquestioned power, but you don't know who they are and it kind of doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like more of the sadness and it, thinking of, actually Fire Walk With Me. And that last shot, you know, the bright light kind of washing everything out. There's a lot of similar shots in this of that. And it felt like transmutive or something. I don't know.
Totally.
I'm usually not like this hard into things, but it just but just this time I felt really sad for all the young women that have passed through and been ruined. And that was kind of I felt like this movie was really like a song for them.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Just wow.
Drop mic drop.
I love that. I love that.
Chelsea?
Oh, you know, I feel like I did a little preemptive. If you want to, I can add more stuff, but I would say.
Go ahead. You know, it's just, your turn.
Yeah. You know, I think, to both of your points, I think that there's a lot of through lines thematically with David Lynch. I think, you know, David Lynch is definitely a feminist, and I see that in a lot of his work. And I also appreciate that he is decidedly for being as seemingly inaccessible or, you know, maybe just overly gilded or esoteric. I actually think he's extremely unpretentious, and I really appreciate that. I initially was somebody who was not a huge fan. I remember, like, I was dating a guy who fucking love Lost Highway, and I had to sit through that twice, and I was like you just say what you mean. I'm one of those kinds of people that gets a little I get a little pissed off. Not like I love puzzle pieces, and I love puzzle type of movies, but I think at a certain point there is when it feels overindulgent. And I will say I have more clemency towards Lost Highway in lieu of having now watched his other works, including Firewalk, including Twin Peaks. And Laura Palmer is such a great example of what I think can be applicable to this interpretation, to the interpretation of Mulholland Drive, which is that Betty and Diane could both be real. It's all the same. You can, women contain multitudes. People contain multitudes. You know, Laura Palmer was snorting cocaine and she was also feeding the elderly. Like, you know, it's like the duality of people. And also it's a little bit of like it feels a little bit like if you're really reducing it to somebody who hasn't seen it, like a fancy sliding doors in a way. A bougie sliding doors a little bit. Like, it's not who's to, like, that you can interpret it as all material and real that's happening. You can interpret it as all a dream, but there's also that added element of, like, even if it is just cerebral, it's still real to you know. It's always that meta quality. Like, he loves his viewers, and he's not going to tell you what to think. And it makes sense that he wouldn't want Justin Theroux to just perform a facsimile of him, because he wouldn't want it to just come off as this self indulgent jerk off fest. It's more about letting you just develop your own intuition. There you go. There you go.
Beautifully said.
Wow. I feel like I'm the odd one out on this one. I love this movie. I love this movie. I'm just not a big, I'm not like 100% on board with David Lynch, and Greg knows this. Like, I do like him. I like his work, but I'm not obsessed. I don't know.
That's okay.
Thank you. But I do love this movie. I really love this movie, and I feel like it, everyone who's just like, it's too confusing, it's too complicated, I think it's actually really simple, Greg. I agree with your interpretation. It's just like, sure, the first half is this fever dream she has about her life, and she turns her life into a movie. The woman she loves turns into a femme fatale, and it's about this bigger theme of like falsity and false dreams and hopes and promises in Hollywood. I love what you said about the women of Hollywood. That's so, so great. I mean, I do love this movie, but I'm not too confident about top 10.
That's fine.
I don't know. Well,
I mean, there are so many movies. It is understandably incendiary that there are so many that wouldn't be.
I mean, top 10 is a cruel. It's a cruel challenge.
It's a cruel challenge. I agree.
Inherently, they're showing the cards of the sort of like the general mix of people putting in their two cents that carries weight to create that list. Right. Like, when you see the pattern of what is there, like, you know, it's just people are not going to not project.
And I love how like fuck it he is about I'm not explaining anything. I love that. I really respect that. But I can't shake the feeling that if it was anyone else, it would not be allowed. And so it makes me think about like directors who want to do a similar thing but probably can't. Who would allow someone to make this movie?
Bo is afraid.
I mean, yeah, now. I don't know.
I don't want to jump ahead on your notes, but to the point of what you were just talking about of this, interpret it however you want. I do think this is the one movie where he may, and I think it's come up in other interviews where he's like, I may have overly like telegraphed how to interpret.
Really?
Just from, because that used to be an insert I was actually looking for in my DVD.
The insert. That's my next point.
The 10 clues thing, because it actually sort of overly indicates one interpretation.
Let's talk about
it. But I don't think he really wants you to do that. So that's why, like, mine didn't end up having that when I got it brand new. Wow. But then when I rented it, it did used to have it. And I think he was like, oh shit, actually, maybe I'm putting the bumpers up on the bowling lane too much.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think I owned this movie a couple times on DVD because I would lend it out and someone would just keep it and then I have to buy it again. And I think like the first copy or two had that sheet, like David Lynch's 10 clues to understanding.
I think it got rescinded.
And then later it was like not in there anymore. And it's certainly not discussed now. It's not in the Criterion. So it's something that I think he does regret.
Well,
I have.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Exactly. That's my next point. I couldn't help
but
notice
it. Let's talk about it. Yeah. So the original DVD release included a little card with 10 hints from the director. It was called David Lynch's 10 Clues to Unlocking This Thriller.
It very clearly indicates a specific interpretation.
Which is?
I can understand why. Which I think that the Betty Diane dream, the idea of somebody getting ruined through Hollywood and, and having a bit of a, maybe a,
I
was afraid, kind of fever dream about it.
But then there's also like, okay, you know, the first one. Pay particular attention to the beginning of the film. At least two clues are revealed before the credits. There's just the jitterbug.
It's the jitterbug and her falling into her pillow, actually.
Right.
So it's like
someone falling into a pillow.
But it's the pillow, of that room.
Oh, right.
And that's...
But there's another one. Well, she's posing with the old people. It's like over the jitterbug.
Yeah,
she's like
right.
posing with them. Almost like she's on a red carpet.
People like to interpret that she won a jitterbug contest.
Oh, she does say that.
Well, she says it twice.
Never mind.
In both the dream and reality. No, that's okay. Like, that's part of what this is.
No, she says it at the dinner. That's how I got into acting.
She says it at the dinner. And I think she mentions it in the airline when she's riding from the airport, right?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
I think you're right.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's just when she's chit-chatting with the old folks. I don't remember.
But why is she definitely posing at the dinner with the old folks? So I think the old folks are
judges or something, or the parents, maybe.
Oh, the judges.
I thought maybe the judges.
They're too old to be parents, maybe grandparents.
They got reimagined as people that are encouraging her to.
That's great.
Like, from there, go to Hollywood, sweetie.
The judges.
And so they go from being these judges that rewarded her this one time to being the people that give her the golden ticket to Hollywood, being like, well, go on, honey. And then they taunt her, and she's all. You know, she's all fucked up at the end, and then it's like these people are now mocking her,
right,
for having why would you tell me?
Yeah, those old. It's so funny. Those old people, old people. I know. I'm just so ageist.
I love them.
No,
that's what they are.
I think this was like one of the times I actually noticed that. Because there's a shot of them laughing in the back of a car. She's not in the scene,
right?
And I'm like, are they demons?
That's what I thought too.
Yeah, I think she feels that way. Like, I could see that being the interpretation by the end. It's like, oh, these are demons that
in her head
that were like, earworms in my head that said that like I should go down this road and ruin myself.
Well, like I lied to those people because they said I'm going to be looking for you on the big screen. It's like all those people you let down that live in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know? Right.
Exactly.
But
that's beautiful.
When they come in the end, you guys,
I mean, that is
a
little ridiculous.
I
think you're right to laugh.
Yeah.
Do you guys laugh when they're like tiny?
Oh no, I was fucking terrified.
It's
actually
terrifying.
I was actually fully terrified.
I think it's meant to be scary. But I think if you watch it like in the broad daylight,
sure,
it looks a little good.
Or if you watching it, you know what's coming.
Mute it.
Cause,
me too.
Yeah, there's certain things.
Yeah, a lot of screaming. Yeah.
I think the first time I watched it, I was scared. But this time around, and it was 10 a.m., I must say. Yeah. That's morning viewing.
That's morning viewing.
I rewatched it at like midnight. So yeah,
that's great.
His films are these like Twilight movies.
I wanted to watch it at night. I was like, I can't watch it during the day. And then I ended up watching it during the day.
The next one is just notice.
This is number two?
Yeah, notice appearances of the red lampshade.
Right.
Oh.
And of course, the red lampshade is next to the phone that she picks up. That
I think it's one of it feels like one of those clues that's overly indicative of trying to tether you to the Diane identity.
I think so too.
Yeah. Like I feel like I see why it would get pulled that he would initially say all this stuff and then be like, no, you know what? Let people think what they want to think.
But then it also it's funny because it goes back to the whole plot about like the girl is still missing and then they call someone and then they call that phone. So it's like she is the one that ordered the hit on her. Mm-hmm. You're right. It is. Yeah. I think it's overly.
I
don't know.
You're like you go through the whole
list
and everything. I didn't mean like you do your job. No, I meant it more just like if you you go through when you go through it, it does feel very like this is actually a very clear suggestion.
Next one is, can you hear the title of the film that Adam Kesher is auditioning actresses for? Is it mentioned again? Sylvia North's story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is mentioned again. I don't know. That one kind of...
Yeah, I don't know.
Huh.
But then people have interpreted Sylvia North. She says she's from... Where does she say she's from? Some lake.
Yeah, is it significant that it happens to be that particular biopic that they're doing? Like, what's the thematic relevance of that?
Of that life of story. That.
Yeah. And then an accident is a terrible event. Notice the location of the accident.
Mulholland Drive.
Well, yeah, but that's like super obvious.
It's in the title.
I can't imagine that, actually.
Do you know David Lynch's quote on The Road? and why this is called Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
He said literally, he's like, at night, I can't do David Lynch. At night, you ride on the top of the world. In the daytime, you ride on top of the world too, but it's mysterious. And there's a hair of fear because it goes into remote areas. You feel the history of Hollywood in that road.
Yeah.
So true. I remember first moving to LA and being up, like running errands as a PA on Mulholland Drive and overlooking the city. And you're like, I've made it, baby.
It's got that duality of treachery and prestige. I will say, be the pisser on that one. The accident is the same place that Diane gets out of the car for her to go to, because she has to walk up to the house. So the added significance of like her life being shattered at that. Again, like I said, just it's overly indicative of this
Do you guys see that interpretation? Is that
I see it, but I also respect and appreciate that it can be more open ended. Like when I first had rented it when I was like fucking like 14 or something, and it had it in that, and I went down that rabbit hole of trying to, well, there's got to be an explanation and a reason for all this, and so it just kind of pinballed in that way.
But I think it's kind of nice too, because like if it was really complicated, it wouldn't, I don't know, like I think initial thoughts on this movie should be your, not your only thoughts, but those should be the most indicative to you about how you feel about this movie is your initial thoughts. And truly the first time I saw it, that's immediately what I thought. And I was like, there's no need to dive deeper. I'm just going to like enjoy this.
That's unusual for you.
I know, a little bit. There's one more that's like, I mean, there's a bunch. There's who gives a key and why. I mean, that's like the blue key, obviously. Notice the robe, the ashtray, the coffee cup.
That's such a David Lynch clue. Like,
I don't get that one.
I don't know.
This one's good. What is felt, realized, and gathered at the Club Silencio? That it's all an illusion, and how moved we can be by something that doesn't exist.
Mm. It's again, all of that clue stuff is so very clearly telegraphed of like, look very closely at Betty at slash Diane.
Right.
Like the you know, the coffee, Google, all that stuff, you know.
Right.
Then, oh, you know what? Yeah. Oh, sorry. No, go ahead.
No, I just, when they're at Silencio, they're both crying, but Betty's the one that's
shaking,
you know, having that seizure kind of thing. Then she disappears after, and then it's the portal has to open the key.
Yeah.
Silencio is such a classic Lynch scene in terms of like if there's a musical performance, they have the red curtains.
Extremely Twin Peaks. Because I watched that after the fact. I was like, oh, it's
very Red Room.
Oh, yeah. No, he has themes.
Yeah. And too, actually, I just remembered with the coffee cups. I wonder if he's talking about, because the first time we're at Winky's with Patrick, I forget the guy's name, is from Mad Men.
Fischler.
He's great. One of those great character actors.
I love him.
Yeah. Utz. Take it from a nut. Utz are better than nuts. Yeah. So he, the first scene with him at Winky's.
Yeah.
When him and the Bruce Greenwood lookalike guy get up to leave Winkies to go behind the dumpster, there's a shot and they're walking towards the door to leave the diner, and you see two coffee cups on a table. It's not their table, because their table had like he hadn't touched his food.
Right.
The camera like makes a note of like, oh, he hasn't touched his food.
Yeah.
You just see two cups. And then later when Naomi Watts and Laura Herring are there, like you see those two cups in the same place. It's almost connecting, like those things happen on the same day.
Yeah, or like, and she also has the same mug in her house, I noticed. When she's making herself coffee, she has that classic like brown 60s cup.
Also fun to note that the woman that plays the hobo behind the diner is the woman that plays the nun in like the Conjuring movies. It's the same woman. And she's done a couple other things
now,
too.
She's in Princess Diaries.
Oh, you're right. She is, yeah.
Slay. Super slay.
That creature.
The sock.
I know you got these clues, but
No, it's one of the clues.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it says, note the occurrences surrounding the man behind Winkies.
Is it a man?
Because
it's supposed to be her, I thought, right? Like a sludgy body that was left somewhere. I don't know. Maybe that's
why they took away the insert. It's a gender issue. Like we're going down.
I thought it was supposed to be like Betty / Diane.
I think it's right. God.
Oh. Okay.
Because he says, he's like, he's the one that's doing it. And then he has the cube.
Yeah.
Or the devil.
Yeah. The God or the devil. Someone.
Same.
Yeah. Some higher same being.
Yeah. I think there's no God in this film.
Yeah. You guys know what I love about that Winky scene?
Mm-hmm.
that there's called Wakeys.
But yeah, that too. There's no background noise.
Yes. Yeah. That's a note for me.
with the yeah. crash site too before.
And when the two women go to Winkies to look for that payphone, they're outside, but you don't hear anything.
That's like a Lynch staple because he does the sound for a lot of his own films. He's often like the sole credited sound designer or like one of a couple. And yeah, that's his whole thing is the taking away of sounds. And even right there with Eraserhead, his first film, you just hear this like industrial churn.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's his whole thing.
And I love that. Like, I know that sound is important. It's an obvious thing to say, but it does seem as though maybe people don't lovingly spend the time with it the way he does.
They don't.
Right.
A great example, too, the beginning of Blue Velvet when the guy has a heart attack and the camera goes under the grass and to all the bugs and you hear the like.
Yeah.
He's such a master at that. Yeah.
He is.
God.
The last clue, which kind of trips me up. Where's Aunt Ruth? Oh. They never specify that she... I did notice it's never specified. In my mind, she was always an actress, but they never specify that. She just says she's going to make a movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We see the redheaded lady. I always kind of thought that was the implication of her existing in that space.
Same. And she at the end, she came back in at one point.
Yeah, she's the one who sees the box or whatever.
And not to like... I mean, there's also a reference at the audition that the guy who was in the casting room was friends with her aunt.
Right, because he's like, you've done your aunt proud.
Is she this omnipotent type? I don't want to reference Beau right now. I'm trying to. Is she because the fact that she like has somehow communicated to Coco, there's someone in your apartment, and she doesn't like that, and we don't want them there. Yeah, you get them out. They're trouble. Like it's like there's this idea of like surveillance going on with Aunt Ruth as far as like
there's people watching.
People watching, I think, or somebody that's supposed to be like you're looked after within. A certain set of parameters, I guess. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know what I mean? No, it does.
Yeah, I got that vibe.
I love Coco Lanois.
So I just want to be her.
Yeah,
no, that is such a classic LA. Like this movie, I mean, you can watch it and be anywhere in the world and get something from it, impressionistic. But the longer I've lived in Los Angeles, the more I'm like, God, every detail is perfect. Like even just the birds of paradise palms behind them, like just everything is very, even that it's not sunny all the time, it's kind of this like weird gray overcast, and this woman, this landlady, it feels like such a Hollywood figure. She's still doing the glam, you know, she's got the stories. It reminds me of, and this is a tiny role, but Elmarie Wendell played a similar character in an episode of Seinfeld.
The keys.
Kramer is staying at this nasty, you know, Los Angeles place, and she's the landlady. And she talks about,
I could see that with him. He is a big fan of television and comedy.
But she talks about being in the movies and how she was in like a Three Stooges short. Yeah. And she was like, but, you know, they stole a baby, but the baby died. And they were like, and then they all get sent to trial and they're executed. And I think it was just like a, yeah, I don't remember that one.
That's such a great moment.
I know that was such a digression, but
that's perfect.
I feel like it's relevant.
So
it's a
relevant.
Reference. It's
I love it.
It's part of the charm of this movie.
Any excuse to talk about Elmarie Wendell as well.
Yeah.
May she rest in peace.
Also, the guy, sorry, as a side note, the guy who played, not the casting guy, because it's the casting woman and her assistant, but the guy who leads her into the audition.
It's like a producer.
Is that the guy from Poltergeist? Is that the boss from Poltergeist who built the houses over the stones? Oh, okay.
Could be. I
think it's
like
I should have looked it up.
Why don't you just look it up?
He has that great moment in Poltergeist where Craig T. Nelson's yelling at him.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just like, there's so many people in this movie, like Billy Ray Cyrus.
Oh my God, you guys! So Billy Ray Cyrus would go on, like, did you guys watch Hannah Montana?
No, I did
a little bit.
Okay,
I dabbled.
Well, Billy Ray only. 5 years later, you guys, he would go on to do Hannah Montana. What a career.
He's got a good agent.
What a life.
It's what so a life. Funny.
Oh, also, it is the guy from Poltergeist. Sorry.
There you go.
Excellent.
But I never realized how close this was to Hannah Montana. Because I grew up on Hannah Montana.
Totally.
I never realized that it was only 5 years later he would do Hannah Montana, which is hilarious. But that moment where she goes to the audition such a good scene. Like, I'm obsessed with that scene.
So
I'm obsessed with after that scene when they walk out and the casting director's like, God, that was awful. And they're all celebrating inside. All the men are like, oh shit, that was terrific.
Yeah.
It's so good.
So do you know that clip? Have you seen, because I went down a rabbit hole of watching clips from the Dick Cavett show from the 70s.
Right there with
And there's that classic moment where Lily Tomlin walks off because there's this guy she's talking to and he's like, he's talking about the things he owns, like the animals he owns. He's like, and the most beautiful animal I own is my wife. And then Lily Tomlin's like, you own? And she gets up and walks out.
Yeah.
That guy is the guy that she has the scene with.
Where she's my God.
Kissing.
Wow. Perfection then.
Yeah. That's so good. Let's talk about Naomi Watts a little bit.
Yeah, please.
Because
that's her big break.
This is her big break. That scene is incredible. She's incredible in the whole movie, but she's so funny in the first half of this movie, you guys. She's really made me laugh so much. I don't think I laughed that much the first time I watched this.
And now you didn't know what to expect, maybe.
Maybe. And this time around, I'm like, this is hilarious. She's playing it so well. And it's the way it's written, too. Is the
Leave It to Beaver attitude.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, Coco. That was almost my favorite sound.
Yeah.
She says, call me Coco. And she's like, okay, Coco. I love it.
You would love Twin Peaks, honestly.
I know. I have to watch it. That. And then when she's on the phone and she goes, what does she say? I wrote it down. She goes, I'm inquiring about.
Yeah, it makes it really obvious.
It's so funny. And then her phone call with Aunt Ruth when she's like a proper actress, I'll take it out in the courtyard with a cup of coffee.
Oh, so good.
There was also a moment when they were rehearsing lines and she's like, you're really good. She's like, she takes a fake puff on an invisible cigarette and it's thank you, darling.
I'm calling it right now that's your favorite sound.
No.
Thank you, darling.
Oh, okay. It was okay, Coco.
Oh, okay.
But what a performance.
No, she's excellent. She plays like such a range in this.
So it's important too. Like, Lynch has that. Like, some people think he's a bad director because a lot of his films have this very affected gee whiz, Leave It to Beaver thing going on. I think part of that is because that's the world he comes from. But also, I think it's so intentional because obviously people get real. The characters get real when he wants them to.
Exactly.
And because Twin Peaks has had that criticism, Blue Velvet, but all those films are like parodies of this small town aw-shucks kind of thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't seem to pick up on that, or they're just not a good director.
And the dialogue in the first half is very much like an old movie. And I think that's intentional. If we're talking about this whole, that's Diane's dream. Yeah, she's dreaming in the form of a movie.
Oh, no, absolutely. Like, her whole, what you're talking about, the sunny entrance to, oh my God.
The escalator.
And it's Los Angeles. I'm like, I've lived here long enough that now I'm like,
Oh, honey, I have never felt that way. Right? I was born and raised
born here. Yeah, I mean, that's just it.
It's so funny.
What you're saying about it being funny in the way that I think Jack Torrance is very funny at the beginning of The Shining, because this is going to go so bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The way she's clutching the old lady and it's like, we're here. That's going, that escalator is me riding up to AMC Burbank. That's the equivalent. I'm all excited.
Well, then you should be.
Next to the Batman statue.
Magic happens. Oh yeah, exactly. Giant
Batman statue.
You can still get Pinkberry over there. It's a magical place.
It really is.
I see everything with a slightly hazy glow tone, just like the dream sequence.
The Barney's Beanery there is like my version of Cheers.
There you go.
Exactly.
They do this faux street fair there now too. Have you guys been there recently?
Oh no, I know.
Weekends, there's all these vendors set up with tents, and they're trying to give it a vibe. I'm like, guys, this is the Burbank.
You're trying too hard. God.
But then when she does the audition scene, you guys, because it's so funny because she's doing Leave It to Beaver, and then she does the audition scene, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And then she goes back to Leave It to Beaver, and then, of course, there's the ending.
Well,
so
I think, Chelsea, what you were saying about duality and the idea that we don't expect someone who's gee whiz golly to have the depth. Right, that she shows.
Or even to be lesbian. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. It's just I think it's this weird exhilaration she's getting.
Yeah.
from every moment of this new life.
Yeah, like, exactly. If we're seeing it like it's just this true dream sequence, and yeah, it is all happy-go-lucky, she would fucking nail that audition scene. Yeah. She would do the perfect audition
scene.
She would do it all.
And she would be taken to go meet a director. Exactly.
And if she couldn't get the role, it would have to be a conspiracy. It would have to be all this shit. There has to be all this nefarious shit, and not just that she got like, and not just like potentially one interpretation being just the sad reality that she got fucked. And she wasn't actually maybe that good. And it should have been a contest isn't an acting audition. Maybe that's the versus the, no, she was good. And there is all that. There's just all this other crazy evil shit going on. And a guy in a cowboy hat.
The cowboy's so funny.
I love the cowboy.
I love the cowboy too. Before we talk more about the cowboy, I just want to say that it's so interesting that she made Camilla Rhodes, like, if we're thinking this like story, right?
Yeah.
Camilla Rhodes got the role instead of her, right? So in the dream, in the first half, Camilla Rhodes is played by that woman who she's jealous of, who like kisses the real Camilla.
Right.
And not actual Camilla, who's like the femme fatale of the story.
Right.
I don't, it's so cool. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I
just, no, it's interesting.
Like, she made the evil person who got the role this woman that she's jealous of.
Yes.
Now, no, that,
rather than it was actually
that fully
her
makes sense. And sorry, I'm
no,
sorry.
No, please take it.
But just also too, it jumping off that, you bring up an idea I was thinking of, which is, you know, who's to say that the second half isn't also the dream slash what is real? And how realistic is it that she would get in cahoots with this lady so quick, you know, with Camilla, and then. And then get burned. And then why would there be such a torture? Like, why would she get invited, like get sent a car to go up the hill, to go to this basically humiliation fest?
Yeah,
exactly.
So it's hard, you know,
maybe
that,
they
that
were
is
never
also,
sleeping together.
That is also a possibility. Why would there be such cruelty? Like, why would there be an expense paid towards that cruelty against her in that way? So it's cartoonish in a different direction. Right. You brought up a good point, is what I wanted to say.
Yeah, no, you're right. Everything you said makes total sense. The cowboy.
I thought we were out of that.
No,
I mean, I wish I had like written down specifically the lines he says, because there's not that
it's
many.
So funny.
But there's just something very satisfying about watching that guy cut this like very self-assured asshole, like stereotypical director guy, a guy we've all had to work for or with, and like who's just everything. The fact that he used a golf club as his choice of weapon. Yeah. I don't, you know, like, just like, fuck you, dude. Like,
why
I
hate, did he have that golf club with him?
Because he golfs.
He golfs, and he's
why
got the.
Why would he just take one club with him to a meeting?
I don't. I think there might have been a bag, but we didn't see it. We didn't see it.
I didn't see
it. We didn't see it.
I like the idea of that just expressing how ineffectual he is. The idea that he is that like he couldn't defend himself, and then he gets cucked, and then he doesn't know how to advocate for, like, if this is all through Diane's dream sequence, and she, like, let's assume she fucking hates this guy and just wants to look at him get humiliated. Look at this loser getting cheated. Look at this guy getting threatened, you know, by a real masculine figure. So I guess.
Yeah.
I
just, no, actually, that's a really good point.
It's an idea. Right. It's also, I love the, you'll see me once if you did good, twice if you didn't. And then we do, that is.
But then we do see
that
him.
Little, like, so what does that mean?
Oh, like, I never thought about that.
I know. Is he talking just, I think,
is he
you
talking
know,
to
he's
us?
Talking to us.
Yeah.
Right?
Us. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what are his conditions? If you see me once.
It means you did
well,
good.
But if you just see me twice, you did bad. And you see him two more times.
Yeah.
You see him two more times?
Well, because he wakes up. He wakes her up. He's like, pretty girl, it's
time
to
wake up.
And then
he's also
in the background. He passes through the background.
Yeah.
I do think it's funny. I will say, speaking of humor, this is maybe not a thing to laugh at, but when he is like pretty girl time to wake up, and he sees, you get a shot of her and she looks more corpse-like, and he just like shuts the door. He's like, not my monkeys, not my circus. Just,
God.
Just rewatch. So it kind of, it reminded me of Succession.
No, that's great.
That's funny.
Yeah, but there's something about that cowboy that's just,
I love that.
Great role.
Yeah. You're too busy being a smart aleck.
Yeah. No, and like, as much as I hate people who say that kind of thing, like smart aleck, you know, I hate that phrase because it's been lobbed at me. But I really think there was something,
Yeah, the way he's cut down to size by a cowboy. Like, all the threatening and the gangsters is kind of like just background noise. But this weird guy coming out of the darkness is more unsettling than, like, anything else.
It's funny to me, though. Yeah. Like, you say the word unsettling, but it's hilarious.
I think you got the right takeaway there. Because it's so absurd.
It's absurd, exactly. It's total absurd.
But he makes it, like, believable in the way, like, it has a dream logic.
Yeah.
It has a dream logic.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't, like, fill me full of dread or anything, but it, I don't know, it's amusing. I think I would say that. I think it's an amazing
It feels
scene.
Absurd enough with, for me, like, watching it, just, like, it is a tertiary enough character. I'm like, I don't give that much of a shit if it gets carnal right now, but, I was always the most tense because I cared the most about the women, so, like, in that situation, it is kind of like, what are you going to do? What's going on?
Yeah, but I love how Adam is aware, like, even when he's in the meeting with the two mobsters and he's just like, what is going on here, excuse me,
it's my
and
movie.
Same
it's
with the cowboy.
He's ineffectual, he has my power
cowboy, am I gonna wear my 10 gallon?
I mean, he goes so hard on all those jokes, like, to the point where even his, like, assistant is like, okay, funny guy.
If it is her dream, she did at least make him funny.
She gave him a lot.
It's true.
Well, and see, that's the thing too, is, like, I know we think of this as the women's movie, but And everything is, like, tied to them. But it is interesting how there are all these scenes and plots and people that we don't really ever get more of. And that's fine.
Yeah.
But they're part of the world.
Yeah, no, exactly. You touched on it. I think, too, it's probably for the pilot, right? He's kind of setting up different threads. But as a film, what they end up doing, all these threads that don't really pay off, it just adds to the texture of
the dream logic.
The dream, the dream, LA as a dreamscape.
You bringing up that it could have been a good, like, that is a good point that, it is the texture of Twin Peaks that makes Twin Peaks, right? You know, it's not about who actually killed Laura Palmer. It's about everything around. Mm-hmm. It's what she represents. And then the idea of, like, he moves that to L.A., like, all right, it could have been a really good show, actually.
Right.
Does anybody know, is there a stable at the top of Beechwood Canyon? I don't even know.
I don't know, but I believe it. And I
believe it, too.
I know you brought up Mulholland Drive earlier, like, the physical place. And I know David Lynch has a house on, like, that's where he lives on Mulholland Drive. But there, I totally hear what you're saying about that road being...
It's glamorous and treacherous.
It is the road.
Right.
It's like the road in Los Angeles, because if you're at the right place, you can look down over the valley and see it. You can see the ocean. You can see the other side of the city.
Right.
And then just, I don't know, when I first moved here, I read about William Mulholland, who that is named for, and the guy who brought water to LA. And it's just, I think there's something like, again, this is such a, like, Los Angeles is fully the DNA. Like, there is nothing else in here. Like, it's just, even Winkies, it's like, God,
Bob's Big Boy.
Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't just shoot there.
I know, right?
I'm surprised he didn't shoot at the Johnny's over by over by you. There's that place, too.
I mean, that's just it, right? Like, there's all these kind of, like, not quite great diners or sort of family, like, they've been around for decades and everyone knows, and somehow
they haven't... that tableau.
The texture. It's all the texture. And I'm even like, you wanted to come to Winkies?
Great point.
This Winkies. This Winkies.
Well, because I think he got that, because he, you know, famously went to Bob's for every day for like 10 years for lunch and ordered the same thing and took all of his cast meetings there. And people are probably like, he probably had years of people telling him, Bob's, like, really? Okay, sure.
What did he order?
I don't know.
I would like to know the answer to that.
I think, tuna sandwich or something. I think it was tuna.
Tuna.
Yeah, diner is so classic Hollywood. It's a great thing really you guys are bringing up, too. And I think, like, Quentin was obsessed with House of Pies. And, like, it's very...
Wait, is Quentin obsessed with House of Pies?
He was. That's what, like Pulp Fiction, like, drafting and all that. He was very much part of that. And then I know for others, like Fred 62 at different points was a little bit of a, like, a muse of sorts, a muse setting.
People, and certainly Pan's Diner has been the location and setting. I love that Googie style. Yeah. Like, we have a lot of, the diner culture is strong. And that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, there's just every element of this is authentically or feels authentically like Los Angeles. And not just in its present, but, like, in its history. And I mean, one detail I want to bring up is and I'm going to call her the Banshee, but her name was Louise. She was the woman who comes and knocks on the door and says, somebody's in trouble.
Yeah.
That's Lee Grant. Right?
Oh.
Lee Grant, who was blacklisted like when she was 19 or 20.
You guys are bringing up so many great Easter eggs. Like it just adds to like fuck the list of clues. Like this is just LA. Like it's just a mood piece on LA. And if that's all you take away.
Yeah.
I mean, like I think that's how I'm going to tell people about it from now on.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the three great LA films, probably, if not number one, maybe.
You're thinking like Chinatown and.
Probably Chinatown and like, I'm a big fan of, oh, Sunset Boulevard. Which is.
Bring up Sunset Boulevard.
Lynch is a big fan of that movie.
Yeah.
Such
a good movie.
And
also just the fact that like that's named Sunset Boulevard. This is called Mulholland Drive.
Yeah. I think that's it. He's not a big.
Get that great pan up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the street sign.
Yeah. And those are good movies too. Both Chinatown and Sunset thematically tying to this, like, especially Sunset, of a woman driven mad with the idea of herself and her relation to the town, and then also that nefarious quality of the underbelly of it, and then same with Chinatown too.
Oh yeah,
and the
like massive power that you can't fight against.
Exactly,
like corruption. Yeah.
There is this entity that's so beyond you.
Yeah. Have you guys seen Day of the Locust?
I have not.
That one is it manages to be the bleakest of all of the Hollywood stories. Like even this times two, honestly.
Wow.
That's based off a book, right?
Yeah, it's based on a book. I haven't read. Yeah, Nathaniel West?
Yes.
Yes.
You know what? I have the book, which I've also not read, but I have as part of. I read like a couple of his stuff. Yeah, I could see that being
right.
The movie is incredible. It's Karen Black, Donald Sutherland, and it's John Schlesinger. I think it was his follow up to Midnight Cowboy, maybe a couple movies after Midnight Cowboy. Still, but like, it's really fatalistic.
I don't want to stir the pot too much, but I know Chelsea, you love Babylon, right?
You know what? I do, and please feel free to look.
Well, you mentioned underbelly.
I think
everything we're talking about the death of the Hollywood dream, and
I
all
will
that.
Say it hit me, and I watched it at the right time. It hit me in a great way. I got everything Damien Chazelle was putting down, and I was there for it.
Great.
That being said, is it as competent in expressing, I think, that duality that this film is doing? No.
Right.
I love it because Babylon to me is just like, it's an opera of a film. Like, it is very much like, Rent wishes it was Babylon in that sense. You know what I mean?
And,
well, yeah, because I think in terms of structure, it feels very La Boheme. I don't know if you watched Babylon, you know.
Yeah.
I understand the dismay of that. You know, I get it. I think I would not be surprised that he would be potentially a big David Lynch fan. I think that there are certain images he's very much a fan of and paying homage to. And I do think that Mulholland Drive it really drives that point home. And, you know, in a bit more of a somber way or in a bit more of a, you know, darkened way.
Of course. And that was the main criticism of Babylon, was just that it's too beautiful to do what this
it's
movie
interesting
does.
You say too beautiful, like, I've heard the opposite of it's too crass. You know, you open like on an elephant taking a shit, you're making
crass,
a choice.
But it's also like
opulent?
It ends with him crying at
Singing
in the Rain.
Oh yeah.
And
it's
you get
very
all
clearly
the
2001 and, Space like, Odyssey
yeah,
like signaling and anyway. I understand the yeah.
But I thought when you said underbelly, like it just clicked.
Yeah.
The armpit of Los Angeles.
Oh, totally. I know. That's I think you're very valid.
Like, I think it's interesting to note too that like David Lynch is not necessarily like a big film fan. He's not like a cinephile, and his reference for stuff, which I think why he feels so original, he's not calling on a bunch of stuff that he's seen
that's
from
so
back
true.
In the day. I know he is a fan of Sunset Boulevard, so you can feel that sort of in this movie, but virtually, you know, like 95% of filmmakers working today are inspired by Lynch in some way. And the way that people that are in a Lynch film, every director they work with afterwards just ask them about Lynch. They're like, what was that like? And just, you know, obviously you guys in Twin Peaks changed everything. Like the David Lynch influence. And I think that speaks to why this film is on the list too. Of just like, it is his one of his most complete and accessible films.
It's everything around them, not just them.
Totally.
Like it's that meta quality. Yeah.
Although I gotta say, I think my favorite David Lynch is actually The Elephant Man.
great movie.
I haven't seen it.
It's so good.
It's still a David Lynch movie.
It is.
But it's set in Victorian England, it's amazing.
And it's Anthony Hopkins.
I'm down. It's so down. It is too. So good. It is like such a beautiful testament to like the human spirit.
It does.
It is sad. It is sad, but it's so fucking good. It's beautifully done. And Bancroft is great.
Oh, I love her.
Anthony Hopkins, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And fun fact about that movie is that his name doesn't appear in a credits, but Mel Brooks produced it.
Yep.
Wow. Interesting.
Because he saw Eraserhead and it was like, oh, this kid.
But do you know what Mel Brooks said about David Lynch? He sounds like Jimmy Stewart if he was a Martian. Or like Jimmy Stewart from Mars.
I was going to say, when you're like, you couldn't do the impression, I was like, he just sounds like somebody's always shouting over like a helicopter. Yeah. Like, it's okay. Like, then it's a little nasal.
We're going now.
And it's Friday. And we're listening. Exactly. You know, that's not the very
Naomi.
Naomi.
You crushed it. You crushed it.
That's all we needed.
Wow.
That's funny.
Talk about some of the ways that he, I mean, the way, so it's funny, Peter Deming, who's the DP on this, I think his first film with Lynch was Lost Highway. I could be wrong, but he's used him every time since. I don't know if he was on Inland Empire, which I actually rewatched. Have you guys seen Inland Empire?
That's one I haven't seen.
Only bits of it. Like, I tried to start it at one point. I think it was too high and I got scared.
Oh, yeah.
The imagery, it got really scary for me.
Yeah.
I think that's part of what Mulholland Drive is like. It's scary, but I watched it in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
I was not cool enough to have access to drugs at the age that I watched it. So I was of sound body and mind. Yeah, exactly. Whereas with Inland Empire, I think I got like way too fucking scared way too fast watching it. I don't know.
That one too, it's just not like an audience friendly movie.
Sure.
And I watched that earlier this week. I hadn't seen it since the theater. I don't know. Yeah. But like watching Mulholland Drive after that, like Mulholland Drive's like butter. It's just like
butter. Like butter.
But I was gonna say Peter Deming's the DP who shot Austin Powers. The same DP of Austin Powers as David Lynch's
DP.
I think he at least did the first one. He might have done the
first two.
Those ones are great. Those first two are great.
But the ways that Lynch kind of offset, like the Lynch touches, because it's not like the visual look of his movies is that radical. Like, yeah, you get, you were talking about with like the flashes of white. Like, he does the strobe light a lot. He does like the red curtains. And then he does like the flashes of Naomi Watts with the older couple.
They almost feel
like
low tech in a way.
Yeah.
Like, those first few shots of Mulholland Drive do feel a little bit like
with the jitterbug. Yeah.
Exactly. The jitterbug.
It's a weird comp shot.
The shaky POV into the pillow and then that dissolve of Mulholland.
Yeah.
And again, I'm cheating. I just like rewatched that opening bit there, but it does feel like.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, especially. Wait, low did you guys see the newest season of Twin Peaks?
Yes.
The Return. Mm-hmm. That was some of the computer effects in that were like very low tech. Yeah. Like, or just like, it looked like it cost $5. And at first, I was so thrown off by it. But I'm like, oh, that's just like your thing.
I also see him being like, let's not overly gild this. They'll get it.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
They'll get or they won't. It's not like,
and I've heard, I know Lynch doesn't often talk about his movies, which, like, you know, good call. Just for any director, honestly. But, I've heard him speak, though, about his fascination with darkness and the idea of darkness being non-existence and that we all emerge from darkness at some point. And so, and there's like other stories that he tells about this, but I guess when he was really young and he grew up in Idaho, because he's definitely like it was definitely a small town vibe, but he said sometime in the night, he said in our neighborhood, back then the street lamps weren't very bright, they didn't light everything. And he was walking home from a friend's house, and a naked woman emerged out of the dark.
Right. That's where Blue Velvet came from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's like more to that story. Like,
that just explains so much about him.
Being a young boy and just like being totally confused.
In
about,
like, what, the 50s, 60s?
Yeah, exactly.
50s. Where did he grow up?
Yeah. 50s. Yeah.
No.
Whoa. Yeah, it's pretty wild. That. Yeah, because he did grow up in this very all-American sort of small town thing. And he was like, I mean, you see old pictures of him as a kid and he just looks like some 50s kid. Yeah. But he was like starting to do these weird paintings and he was interested in like dead animals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But just in the way, Michael J. Anderson, who plays the small man from Twin Peaks, is here, but he's in this prosthetic suit. It's like this full-bodied suit, so they're just using his head to just kind of give that. He's sitting in the chair.
Yeah.
Just to give up this weird sort of not quite right quality. Yeah, and he loves the spotlights and...
Yeah, and like, again, the curtains. And, sometimes like just a piece of furniture that's by itself and just being by itself seems... stark and eerie. Right.
Yeah. You know, like, well, I remember hearing, I think Laura Dern was being interviewed about Wild at Heart, and she was like, yeah, we were filming, and then David would just cut, and he'd be like, hold on, this corner needs like a desk. And then he would literally take 20 minutes and like build a desk, because he's very crafty.
Yeah.
And he would just like build a desk, and then it would be there. He'd be like, okay, and then they would continue shooting. So it was like... Right. Furnit, all that stuff is like so
I just saw important. Some tweet about this, like yeah. that he wanted there to be in a scene in Twin Peaks two ashtrays full of cigarettes to signify Laura Palmer's duality, and there was only one, so he paused filming to smoke an entire pack of cigarettes to fill the ashtray. Yeah,
I love that.
I didn't realize I had this many stories about David.
Yeah,
this is fun to listen just on these details you guys are sharing.
I mean, I don't have all of it, but you know, we all have something.
Well, just it kind of adds to, like, it helps sort of, like, I think it better. Should it be as ranked as high as it is? I have not seen all of the movies to say, but I can better appreciate the like the respect of that. Just all yeah. the details and the intentionality and like.
It's the love
of the craft.
I love that.
You know one detail I really love? I love the detail when Mark Pellegrino, he's the hitman, and he kills the guy with the book, right?
Oh my God, we haven't even talked
and
about
the,
this.
The guy's dead on the desk, and there's that one hair. There's the hairs that are like gelled that are sticking out to the side.
And it's just like on purpose. Everything's on purpose.
Yeah,
you know?
It's just a great little Lynch touch of like, what is that? We don't know.
It's so funny when he comes in and he's like, just doing some stuff for this guy.
Yeah.
And then the guy's like, and are you making ends meet? And he's like, hardly. I'm like, oh, that's an assistant. Like
yeah. Me. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's everybody. Everybody in LA is doing
just
some stuff
doing
for
some
guy.
Stuff for this guy.
No, that scene is like. At first, I forgot how that scene went. It's like almost a Coen Brothers.
Oh my God.
It kind of is
Coen Brothers. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's so funny.
The woman screaming as he's like dragging her down the hallway. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Something bit me real bad.
I really felt though for the custodian.
I know.
He didn't deserve any. Although he was a little inactive, I gotta say.
Yeah. No, that's.
I mean, there's so many.
Hilarious.
If we had the series, we would get a whole. We would. Yes. The custodian, probably.
Oh, and that guy. I mean, who he was in Big Lebowski.
Yes.
Right. He's one.
Where's
of
Where's the money, Lebowski? Yeah.
That's him.
Hey, Woo. Is this guy supposed to be rich or something?
Oh my God,
that's a really good connection between the Coen brothers and this.
I think too.
Lebowski's another very LA movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. LA movie. Yeah. It is.
Like, it is.
And I guess there's a movie called Double Indemnity that.
Oh my God. Oh, just a little one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many great. The Long Goodbye. There's too honestly
too
many.
Too
many.
There's too many. Yeah.
There you go.
LA loves to play itself.
It's so true. I love the motifs that Lynch has with like gangsters, hitmen, thugs, goons. He's obsessed with these like noir tropes. They pop up in so many films. Like, hey, I'm the tough guy and I'm wearing a leather jacket and it's like
making a call and it's like she's still missing. And then making another call and then another phone.
Like
rings.
Robert Loggia in Lost Highway.
Yes. I love him in that. When he like goes after those people for tailgating.
Yes.
The goon that comes to the house, like Adam's house.
Oh, and that woman like swinging off of him.
His wife.
I mean, I don't like that he hits her, but it is funny the way she throws her whole body on him and he just is still
big.
Unaffected.
Like he is tall and like, I don't know.
Yeah.
He's just a large man.
And you got Dan Hedaya, who's one of the ultimate goons in cinema history, just in general.
Love Dan.
In the scene, the guy that's
so intentional, like the choices made to
and he's also a Coen guy. He's in Blood Simple.
Yeah, he is.
But,
and Clueless.
Most
importantly, Clueless.
He's the best.
He's the dad,
Clueless.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh yes, the best dad there ever was.
No. The guy that spits out the espresso is Angelo Badalamenti.
Yes, I did not know that until
I
this
didn't
watch.
Know that.
And I gotta say, I don't think he so much spits it out as he opens his mouth and allows it to fall out.
I remember when I first saw this in high school, that really disturbed me for some unspeakable reason, because they come in and the guy starts shaking.
Well, I mean, like clearly the whole negotiation is resting on that.
The coffee.
Being right. And while that does seem, it is absurd. I'm like, but have you read People's Writers?
Yeah.
Like that they have to have the certain thing and the specific, like that now that no longer seems outrageously unrealistic to
it
me.
Doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't.
Like, it's so real. Like it's so true. Just the way things are just decided, like just like hairpin, impulsive, totally. Petty, just stuff like that. Just like, I just don't like the look that person gave me. we're going to blacklist them. Like, it's just I don't like the way this coffee tastes.
I don't like Coke Zero. I only like Diet Coke.
Yeah, I only like Diet Coke. It's funny. This guy brought me Coke Zero. He's fired. I'm from the set immediately. I don't want to see him again.
Yeah.
So true. There's a line in here when she's leaving for her audition, just to show like how childish Naomi Watts is. She's like, don't drink all the Coke. She says that to Betty. Like, that's what she could think of as she was leaving. Don't drink all the Coke.
Don't drink all the Coke.
It's so funny.
It's almost,
Did anyone else, just because living in LA, like, before I lived in LA, Scientology was not on my radar at all. Since, obviously, my last apartment was literally feet away from the big blue building, the big monstrosity on Fountain. But does anyone else get a Scientology vibe from this in the sense, like, she's the girl, like...
Yes. Oh, 100%.
Like, this mysterious shadow organization is just like, she's the girl.
I mean, that's still very much a thing that you say, however you feel or think about the actual relationship of Scientology and Hollywood. Like, there is... Again, there's the, you know, you could justify it. Like, again, this is all just in the, just how did the dream, the Diane Betty dream, she's trying to justify wrongdoings against her. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to be like, oh, they're like, just there's this conspiracy against me. But there is that real sort of unspoken, how real is that? That undercurrent going. I mean,
and it's like, you know, pick your group that wants to throw its weight around. You know, it's whoever's in power, whether that be.
You know,
whether it's Scientology or it's the mob or, you know, this
studio
or just the corrupt government itself. You know, it does feel like, I don't know. I love a movie about crumbling institutions.
Yeah.
Now, where does the money come from and where does it travel to?
Right.
To Babylon for a second. I think that it's
follow the money.
The idea of like where... The connections how dirty can it get?
Yeah.
How involved can how threatening can that involvement be?
Yeah.
To what point? Yeah. Yeah.
One moment I love, did we talk about this when, Rita is reading against Betty, like Betty's getting ready.
Oh, she's
her
like intentionally
audition.
Bad. Yeah. Like,
it's so funny.
She's so stilted.
I love that. It's so good.
Something that I want to say I never noticed before, but bothered me this time, is that pinching pink cardigan.
Okay. It's funny. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit.
But I feel like that was the look in the 2000s.
You might be right. I might be like pushing that out of my memory.
Because but it's funny that it does. It's ill fitting. Like almost like it doesn't belong. Like she doesn't belong.
Like
it
she doesn't.
Belong.
Like she doesn't
she's
belong.
She's cosplaying in a role that isn't suited for her.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. And even the necklace was like it looked like a Claire's little. Just it was just definition innocence. Blonde, pink,
and all the rhinestones. The way they shined the filter and the lighting they're already using just makes it add to this whole like it's an unreal quality. It's not grounded. Not a grounded person.
I mean, she doesn't question a woman in the house.
Not at all.
And she's just like, I'm Betty, by the way. Like, I'll let you finish your
it's
shower.
It's like a sitcom.
Totally.
It definitely feels like, the exaggeration of and speaking as someone from the Midwest, that very trusting.
Yeah.
Like, well, look, why we don't need to do that? Like, why would we need to do that?
Why would we need to call the
But
police?
Then also maybe she's like, there's a hot woman in my house.
That's also true.
That's the subconscious in the dream being like, we're gonna follow through on this fantasy sequence.
Yes, we are. I mean, and I gotta say, like, there's a lot of poor eroticism in films.
Yeah.
I think it works pretty well in this, though.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
That scene is very breathy.
I definitely agree.
He does those well. He does them well.
I mean, it doesn't feel exploitative, though.
No,
you know, it's like,
it really doesn't.
And it's so, like, also, and not to be all, you know, Hollywood history, but, you know, the idea of, like, chorus girls coming to town and like sharing apartments. There were lots of like same-sex relationships going on because the comfort of that was so much safer than any of this horrible shit that's being thrown at you outside in the world.
No,
so.
I think that's like you go Hollywood hit. That's what this is for. This is the movie to do it on. I think that's you bring up a good point with that. I think that the comfort and softness and safety, it's not exploited, but more so just like celebrated and lamented and how he's depicting it. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like the way that Lynch I think honors women in his works as opposed to, you know, he definitely a good looking woman, he'll let you know they're good looking.
Yes,
you know.
he'll let you know someone's stacked, but also it's not to the point of like where like
leering.
Where yeah, not a yeah. leering. It's more sort of like, okay, well, this is going to serve in some capacity to, you know,
right.
to add some depth later or to context. And then I think about like oh gosh, the name just escaped my brain. Pedro Almodovar. Mm-hmm. And the way that there's a reverence without a yeah, like without creepy getting, eye. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Without getting a, yeah, sleazy, creepy yeah. eye. Exactly.
Yeah, women are human beings too.
It's so
yeah.
funny, you guys. The movie I watched before this, and I didn't even know that there were lesbians in it, was The Handmaiden okay, by
Park Chan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I haven't seen that either.
I had no idea. And I'm sorry I just killed it because it isn't okay. it isn't clear like when you start the movie.
Wow,
and then it was
Jackie.
This, and I was just like, wow.
Spoilers
like,
for Handmaiden.
Yeah,
ding,
no.
Ding, no.
I'm
no, no,
sorry.
No,
no,
too.
I mean,
no, not at all.
I mean, I've seen
but that's
it.
Another movie that's very, yeah. like...
I look forward to seeing it.
Dreamy?
It's great. Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, it's dreamy, but I just mean, like, the woman, like, the same-sex relationship yeah. in that is, like, very
I've
sacred.
Seen,
and,
I've seen one scene. Yeah. So, that doesn't surprise me so much when you say that, because she talks right. about it, dressing her up like a doll.
Yeah.
And it's very, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she has it. So Betty in this film, like, she is basically a doll. She's Rita's, or sorry, Rita's the doll. That yeah. Betty's just like, oh, this. And she literally makes
yeah.
her the wig and everything.
Yeah.
yeah, she's like a Barbie doll. Yeah.
Well, the wig, and then, like, people talk about, like, persona.
Right. And you guys just ended up, well, like, a month or two ago, you guys did Three Women on your yeah. show.
Three Women, too.
Which is a great one to bring
this
up.
World
this
of, like, yeah. two yeah. women becoming one.
Yeah.
Persona,
yeah.
Mulholland Drive, Three Women all kind of get mentioned
like
in the same
one
sentence.
There's one big one, too,
yeah,
that I'm missing.
There's probably another one. Those are the three big
Freaky Friday?
That's great.
That's a good one.
But in this one, it's like, in Persona, there's that very, like, there's that money shot, right, in Persona where they, like, become one. And then this one kind of has it too, where it's like, oh, you haven't seen
it? I haven't seen it yet, no.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Jackie.
Oh,
don't
be sold it again.
Don't be sorry. We should have that on our list, actually. It's a big one, too.
Anyway, but like, there's a very intentional, like, persona shot in this.
We can only do spoilers for the episode we're talking about.
Oh, we do. We spoiler all over the damn place on our show, so don't feel bad.
People are so sensitive these days.
I know. I mean, at a certain point, it's just like.
You're like, shit.
Honestly.
This
Calm
movie
down.
Came out in the 60s.
I can empathize in both directions.
I can yeah. too, honestly.
It's too, yeah, it's like, it's too, there's a point. There's a threshold yeah. for rationale.
Yes.
There's a rational
there's a
response
threshold.
On
I
both
agree.
Sides.
I feel like over 10 years is good.
Sure.
Number 15.
This is totally a digression. Please cut this out. But there's this great moment in Frasier where Niles has recently been divorced and he decides he's going to watch Casablanca because he's yeah. never seen it before. And basically everybody starts having an argument about the story uh-huh. in the room. And by the end, it's completely ruined for him. And he's yeah. like, why don't you just put on trench coats and act it out?
I'm going to leave that in.
Yeah. As you should.
But Greg, the reason I brought up Persona was just that shot, Greg.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like the
oh,
exiting
for sure.
of Diane's apartment, and it's like shaky.
I wonder, like, too, like, yeah. did Lynch see Persona? I you can't
I
be certain.
So.
I don't know.
That seems
maybe.
Like a, yeah, I think it, for him not being a, like, a quote-unquote movie person, like, I feel like he...
I think he knows the story.
This is
I
this is far too Easter eggy and referential and,
yeah.
and reverential to not
yeah.
right.
be about LA and movies and Hollywood
and actresses.
He's the whole Gilda thing hangs over the movie. Do you
I
guys like Gilda?
That.
Love that.
Do you yeah. like Gilda?
I yeah. love that
I
movie.
Love Gilda.
I have. I
she
don't,
will
I,
love it.
Sure,
you will.
I've seen bits of
you
it.
Will.
I know.
No.
I you know,
it's
I
fine.
Like Rita
no,
Hayworth
it's totally fine.
Stuff,
I mean, but Rita Hayworth, like, yeah, a woman who. You know, many people today still don't know was Latina. And like, you
exactly.
know, like,
yeah, she was so like reshaped and reformed.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
She is a representation of an image.
Yes.
Like, very Marilyn Monroe type
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Plus,
like, insidery Marilyn Monroe.
Anyone
symbol.
Who marries Orson Welles, you know, I'm curious about them.
Yeah.
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 I love Rita Hayworth.
I do too. Yeah.
God.
Pretty lady.
You know what? Sorry, just as I was going through my notes, I just have one more and I realized I should have said it when you were talking about the diner, but cuz you said the hobo, you see the hobo as God.
Yeah, cuz the hobo has the box.
Right, right.
And the guy from Mad Men, I'm forgetting his name.
Yeah. Patrick Fischler.
Yes, says he's the one that's doing it. And he even says, he goes, "I have this God awful feeling." Like, he says it very intentionally, you guys.
Wow.
He really
that's
does.
A really good one to point out.
I think
that's a good one.
I think that scene, honestly, because it's that scene happens before Naomi Watts even speaks
exactly.
in this film. She actually doesn't get her first line until like 20 minutes in. I'd forgotten.
That's a great one.
You see her, she doesn't speak, and then it's the movie sets up all these other threads, and then you come back to her at the airport.
It really feels very like this is like in the mind's eye kind of thing. Like because of that, because she doesn't talk initially, it does feel like this is her projecting these images out.
She's observing.
Right. Yeah, my interpretation. Sometimes I have dreams. I'm not always in the dream. I'm like watching things happen around the dream, or like you're kind of floating above it in a sense. Yes. And he says God awful. It's like, is she like kind of the cruel god in this imaginary world or realm that's controlling this? She is a nefarious person. You know?
No, I like that.
I don't know. That's one way.
I think too, it just like establishes early on, like in this LA of Mulholland Drive, like anything is possible. Like anything can be conjured into any back alley.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But also if you think about it, like if we're thinking about the dream, because when does the dream happen? And I don't think it's important
the
when
pillow
it
shot.
Happens.
Oh, when does her dream start?
Because she sees the guy at Winkies again, Peter Fischler,
Patrick.
How
dare you? So close.
This is Patrick.
Close. Patrick.
I'm gonna write it. See, I just don't say names. You can be like me.
You just say the Winkies guy.
The Winkies guy. She sees him later after she talks to the hitman. He's in that same spot, right? So it's like, if the dream already happened, but now she's seeing him here. When did the dream happen?
It's a Mobius strip. It's just like there's no beginning and no end.
I think so too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's like she has to have had the relationship fall apart to put on the hit. But if this is the beginning of the movie, you know, it's like the snake is eating his own tail.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In a great way.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Should we do Sight and Sound?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yay. Do you want to start then, Victoria? Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just saying that to Chelsea, like on the way here, that, this really affected how I watched it to be really focused on my senses. So thank you. Because I think that it made me watch the movie in a totally different way. So
great.
Love the game.
Nice.
My favorite sight is the shot that's the point of view through tears when she's looking at the fireplace. She's masturbating.
Oh,
but,
God, yeah.
But she's but it's like the blink that clears the vision and then
it
clouds.
Back and forth in POV.
Yeah.
I love
it. It goes like out of focus and then immediately in focus.
Yes, I loved that so much. I was like, damn, that is what it's like to cry.
save the sound. Oh, we'll do sight and then we'll do sound.
Oh, okay.
That's a great sight.
Yeah,
sight. Well, I mean, you know, I put the Winky scare 1656, but then I also put at a particular point and when they're during Jorando, when 151:41 through 6 when Betty and Rita are crying together, and it's Rita's crying, she turns into
I love it
Betty. Like receives her, but then you see her almost get this moment of like awareness on her, like she's watching, but she's a little more like watching, whereas like Rita's looking for this like comfort and Betty's kind of like, this is, I'm like, she gets a little more like, what is going on here, like she gets too aware.
Like, I love that.
And that's the first mention of Jorando too that we've had this so far in this episode.
Oh, I did all my other
keep waiting a little bit.
There you go.
You know, wait. So, I'll mention it later.
Okay. I have two favorite sites.
Typical.
I know. I love it's really early on in the movie. Rita post crash runs into the street, and it's this beautiful wide shot with the palm trees, and it's being lit through this tree, and it's just gorgeous. Yeah. I love that shot. And then I also love the Winkies phone booth shot, because it's incredible. It starts on the window. You know that it's Winkies, even though you don't see the sign Winkies, but you recognize the door. And then they approach. You see them approach, and it pulls back. And
That is
good. It's a great shot.
Yeah.
Nice.
What's yours?
Mine is combined sight and sound.
I love when that happens.
I think it's just because, like, when I think of this movie in my head, this is always, like, the thing that comes to mind. It's during the auditions. It's 16 Reasons, the Connie Stevens song.
Oh, yeah.
And it starts in a close-up of her singing, the actress that's auditioning. Yeah. And it slowly pulls back, and it looks it's like they're beautiful. In a studio, yeah. But then you see it's a set, and it's just, like, the whole Hollywood magic.
That's it. Exactly.
Plus, the song is amazing.
Exactly.
I'll play it right now.
16 Reasons. Why I love you. The way you hold my hand. Your laughing eyes. The way you understand. Your secret sighs. They're all part of 16 reasons why I.
Love that. I love an ambiguous shot. You know, you don't know what you're looking at until mm-hmm. some time passes. It's catchy.
It's yeah. such a good moment. And you're right. It perfectly encapsulates the movie.
And Connie Stevens.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Totally.
Plus, what a great little song. Just count to 16. That's the song.
Oh, I love back those songs of that era where all you had to do was just like write a song about the clock.
Yeah.
And like it's true. Writes itself.
It's yeah. so good.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Like, I guess, I don't know. Like, they're lyrically, all the songs from that era, like doo-wop, are lyrically, like, really dumb.
They're very but,
like,
garbage.
I'm but... so upset. Like, that is, like, my favorite kind of music yeah. on
Even
the planet.
Jorando, you know, that's adapted from Crying, and that's yes. that old exactly. song, too. Exactly. Yeah. But you hear it like this, and it's like, way
yeah. beautiful.
Way more visceral.
Yeah.
But then the original one is very much more just doo-wop-y.
But yeah, yeah Lynch yeah. Lynch loves yeah. that sound. I mean, I'm thinking of, yeah, like, what is it?
Blue Velvet?
In Dreams.
Yeah. In Dreams, oh my God.
In Dreams.
He loves someone lip-syncing to something, which is what this is,
also,
too.
Also, Almodovar does that a lot. Yeah. A lot of those yeah. kinds of, like, a show within a show.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that stuff.
Anyway.
Yeah.
It's good.
Sound?
Victoria?
Oh, am I up for sound? Okay.
You're up for a sound Oscar.
All right. Sweet. I mentioned this in the email, but I really love the sound of that light bulb coming on in the corral when the cowboy shows up. There's something really like the hum buzz of that. They had to spend time making that perfect.
Let's take a listen.
Lynch loves electricity. That's like a running thing with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he took it to a new height, without spoiling anything, in the new Twin Peaks season with, like, that's people were traveling through electricity. Mm-hmm. He, oh God, he's so good. Have you guys seen, I know you guys do not like Mark Kermode. I generally like him. There's a clip of him, though. Actually, let's just play it really quick. It's Mark Kermode asking David Lynch a question about the electricity motif in his films.
One of the recurrent images in your films is of electricity arcing, is of, you know, light bulbs crackling on, and you have a recurrent motif of, you know, like two points and something arcing between them. And it seems to me that this somehow relates to what you think about the synaptic arcs in our brain. When you talk about TM, when you talk about the thing, you talk about making connections. It seems to me that that's what that recurrent visual motif is about. And I know you hate saying what things mean in your films, but am I right in thinking that that's at least in the right area?
No.
I like that. A little bit, he's kind of sort of like spoon feeding the analogy a little bit. So yeah. It's like too easy for David Lynch to be like, no. Yeah. Like, it's funny. Because like, I think it is. It watching the return, it does come off that way. Like, I think that is a very astute observation, yeah. but
mm-hmm. yeah,
it feels more like a plea for affirmation.
Right. Yeah, please tell me I'm right. Yeah, tell me I'm good.
A little bit.
Yeah.
No, I do the electricity. Yeah, when that light comes on too, because there's like a stock clip of like electricity coming on that a lot of movies use.
Yes,
and obviously, they create their own.
No, I've got to.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that kind of. We were talking about the noise going away in scenes like in the Winky scare, and then there's the other corpse scare at 1:30, 6:50, and it's like there's a white noise that's happening actually, and it's kind of like it increases, and then it kind of cuts to not know noise, but sort of like if your ear popped or like your ear was just ringing or something. And in both cases, that's like that, like that's like you're suddenly you're in the eye of a tornado feeling. And those are great. And then of course, just all of Jorando, which is, like the peak of that song around 150, 152.
That's mine too.
It's such a.
You guys have the same one?
We do. So and good. It's because for similar reasons as yours, I feel like that encapsulates the movie to me because I was even fooled. Like, I've seen this movie.
When she gets up into the higher range.
And I was like, I was crying. I was like, oh my God, beautiful. And then when she stops, I'm like, I was tricked.
Yeah. Beautiful.
It was great. It was such a good experience.
Still incredible recording. You know? I mean, wow.
That's my favorite.
Great eye makeup, too.
Eye makeup. Then, okay, that was my favorite sound. Mm-hmm. But then, can I also have it
Well, let's play the clip of that one first. Stunning.
Okay, Coco.
Yeah.
Here it is. Here's Okay, Coco. Yeah,
I put like four in.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, what again? I named like four different things. You can have Coco.
Yes.
You should have your Okay, Coco.
Pleased to meet you.
Oh, just call me Coco. Everybody else does. Wait there and I'll go get the key.
Okay, Coco.
Oh, well, good.
But yeah.
Yeah. Wow. God. Well, we would normally do a Pauline Kael segment here, but she actually passed away the year this film came out. And she had been retired for like a decade at that point. So she did not review the movie, considered pulling Ebert's review or something. But considering this was the only Lynch film he liked, I'm not going to give him the satisfaction of pulling his review. He doesn't deserve it.
What?
Just kidding. So mean. I'm just kidding. I generally like Ebert. I generally like him. He's wrong on that one, though.
Sure. He can be wrong.
Let's do Letterboxd.
Yeah, we have the good people of Letterboxd instead.
Do you guys have any Letterboxd?
I did not find any.
We're just gonna sit back and listen.
All right, all
right. Like we would end up just seeing the same.
Maybe.
Yeah. Don't want to step on your toes. We have like the same, some of the same.
Five stars. This is La La Land's evil twin, which kind of goes with what we said about Babylon.
Yeah. I think it really fits for Mulholland Drive. It's very it's
sort of an evil twin, maybe like an evil upper older sister.
It's about a relationship, the dissolution of a relationship against Hollywood, but for very different darker forces.
It's
fun. Yeah.
I have a half star review here that just says, such a waste of my precious time. I'm truly disappointed. Expected something innovative and memorable, but ended up watching nonsense and porn instead.
What are their top four?
Thought all of the boredom I felt throughout because of the unnecessary long takes and scenes where nothing of importance happens was going to pay off at the end with some smart and shocking twist, but such a letdown, such a debacle.
Okay.
Debacle.
All right. Your time is not that precious if you took the time to write that.
Yes.
Right. Exactly.
And that's the first of three paragraphs. I stopped
what?
There.
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ.
Three and a half stars. Who shoots a vacuum?
Go on.
Another half star. I don't know. I'm just getting a kick out of reading the bad ones.
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
This movie makes me feel like I'm having a stroke because of how damn confusing it is. I feel like I was tripping on shrooms, but also being lectured by Mr. David Lynch himself about what an underground and amazing filmmaker he is.
Underground.
This movie is a great recommendation for pretentious media studies students who love to talk about themselves. The ending of this movie itself felt like the end of a shitty student film. Silencio, like he thought he ate that up. up, girl. STFU.
Ew.
That is gross.
I hate when I'm so sick of certain internet lingo things. Like, yeah, you thought you ate and like,
yeah,
all that.
That's the thing. I've never heard
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Oh, you thought like, oh, you thought you did something there. Or, yeah.
It's called it's, you thought you ate.
Yeah. It's the oh, even just so when someone eat. Oh, sorry, but they ate. Or, oh, you thought you ate. Or, oh, they really thought they did something there. Or just, I don't know.
It's There's annoying. So much.
It's gotten.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
It's gotten shaky.
We good.
So this one's going to be hard to describe because it's a lot of emojis. You guys know the crying emoji?
Oh, yeah.
Show you guys?
Okay.
Yeah. 5 stars. There's an emoji between every word. Okay. She wished she knew how to quit her.
Yeah. That's a good one. That's cute. That's cute.
I know. See, I like pulling the funny, cute ones. Greg likes to pull, like...
This man's a fool. Yeah. Listen to this idiot.
This is my last one. It's another 5 star. Eating a pile of poop, having Gilbert Gottfried scream in your ear, and all the while suffering from COVID is what watching this movie is like. Death is more appealing.
Oh my God.
Also, poor Gilbert Gottfried. Yeah, I think this was written after he had passed, too, I think. January 2022.
Ew.
I think he had already passed.
I think you're right.
It's insensitive.
I just think the ones that are like that volatile and negative, I have to just wonder, like, do you know how bad movies can be?
Exactly.
Like, do you know how pretentious and
they don't
and fuck you, troll, inaccessible, pretentious for the you have not seen that. This is the least of that.
This movie's generous. Like,
this movie's extremely generous.
Yeah. And like it has like that Coen sensibility in some of those vignettes. Right. It's like entertaining.
It's too straightforward in a sense. Like he's had to backtrack.
Yeah. Like, I feel like that's why people are like taking their magnifying glasses to it.
Yeah.
Because it's like there's gotta be something more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're getting too close to the Monet.
Definitely. Yes, exactly. This is my last one. 5 stars. I read somewhere that Billy Ray Cyrus blames David Lynch for Miley's crazy era, and I'm not in the same context as Miley, but I think I'm gonna start blaming every unhinged impulse I have on the Lynch media I've been consuming.
The Lynch media.
Is that true?
What was the star rating on that?
5.
It's not true.
You don't think Billy Ray Cyrus?
Well, I guess they liked it at least. I don't know. That was one of those reviews where I'm like, I feel like they're trying to. There's like it's kind of a. Whatever.
Why yeah, they're going for something.
Whatever. If they rank that high, they have way more clout than me. Don't let me talk too much shit.
Why would they make up that Billy Ray said that?
I don't know.
Just trying to be funny.
Sometimes I think someone overthinks their review and goes like all around. Like I'm guilty of that too.
It's entirely possible Billy Ray Cyrus might have said something to that effect. Like, as a joke or in passing? I mean, we don't know. There's not enough information.
I don't know. It's like they wanted to acknowledge that Billy Ray Cyrus, like the way you were like, oh, yeah. Hannah Montana, you know, you want to acknowledge it. You also like the movie. Mm-hmm. Cool. We both like the movie.
Yeah.
That's cool.
We've talked about, at this point, we're psychoanalyzing the Letterboxd reviews we choose.
It's interesting how certain ones get memeified and certain ones get like over. Like with Three Women, there are no like memey ones. Everything is like this. Everybody has to write a dissertation about this movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Bo, half of the people are just trying to write a bit. And it's like, it just depends on where certain movies hit the. I don't know. It's certain type of cinephile versus general comedian-esque Letterboxd audience. Like, it's weird. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like this one had an interesting blend of memeified reviews. Even the nice ones, you know, as if it's a short thing, it's kind of a joke versus like the longer, that 5 star is like, that was just the first paragraph. It's like, it's interesting just seeing what the general temperature of how people approach discussing a movie and how... I guess how much they want to show that they care. If that makes sense.
It's just sometimes I read them and I think it reminds me of that exercise that therapists will have you do where you write a letter and you don't send it.
Yeah.
Except they sent it.
Yeah. I'm guilty. Who am I to judge?
I mean, I don't know. I get out my angry thoughts in a book where no one sees it.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Exactly.
Well, before we go, we should go around. What's everyone's favorite Lynch film? I know I said mine was Fire Walk with Me.
I brought up Elephant Man.
Oh, Elephant Man. You did say Elephant Man.
This is Mulholland Drive. Yeah. I just really like what this one's doing.
What about you, Jack?
Probably Blue Velvet. Mm. But I also really love this.
So we got
all great choices.
All different choices here.
Actually, I think I like this more than Blue Velvet. I'm gonna go with this. They're
Lock
very
it in.
Close.
Lock it in.
Yeah.
No bad choices.
Firewalk with Me.
Firewalk with Me.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah.
I mean, they're...
It's hard.
It's hard. It's a great... It's like Kubrick films. It's... Yeah. There's... Yeah. It's hard to... It's more about what's your least favorite, I think. Like, right. You know?
Yeah.
Well, there's a correct answer with Kubrick. It's Barry Lyndon. No, I'm just kidding.
Are you for real?
Oh,
you
I'm love obsessed Barry with Barry Lyndon.
Okay. Oh, okay. I was like, do I have to throw to myself flip, out your
I was going
to
say, I got to flip a table real quick.
It's actually playing this... it's playing tomorrow night at the Academy Museum.
Oh, shit.
I saw it in a theater once with Leon Vitali.
Oh, fuck. That would be so fun.
He just passed.
Oh, fuck. That would be so fun. What time? It's probably
I think it's
out.
Like 7:30.
Oh, shit.
And then the Academy Museum, a couple family. Weeks from now, is doing Goodfellas on a Sunday evening. Oh, I know that's like such a bro movie, but like I can't see that enough times on
it's
the big screen.
It's
so good.
A good movie is a good movie.
Yeah, it's you know? True. A good movie is a good movie. Like,
I'm going to a thing tomorrow, but if I can go to this, I'm gonna go.
Yeah, I gotta go see family tomorrow. So if I can get away from
my family is
ball and chain.
Redmond Barry.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Literally, right?
Yeah. Oh my god, I know, right? Those are our people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has been fun.
Oh
thank
my
you,
god,
Chelsea and Victoria. Yes. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Again, if you haven't heard Breath of Fresh Movie, go check it out. We have the link to in the show notes. You guys do a great show.
You guys do a great show. This is. I like. We're kind of like we're like invert. We're not so different, you and I. It's fun.
Well, no, thanks for joining us. This has been a blast. I'm glad that we had your help on tackling this one just because there's a lot to this one. You know, we needed four different perspectives.
It's a treat. Like, it's just, yeah. I just really like this movie.
A treat is exactly right.
Yeah.
Right? That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, do you guys want to plug social media, websites, anything like that?
The Breath of Fresh Movie socials.
Yeah, I mean, you can follow Breath of Fresh Movie on Instagram and Twitter at Fresh Movie Pod. You can also email us at breathoffreshmovie@gmail.com. I mean, I'm trying to get off the medias, so I'm good. You'll be able to find me if you find that.
If you want to, just go to the Breath of Fresh Movie Twitter. It's her Twitter, and in a good way. No, it's like it's good. No, you're doing.
She's
is,
outing me.
This, no, this is how we're here now. Like you do. That's you true. Connect with people. I don't. Yeah. We also have magnets, and.
One of which is on my fridge right now.
I know. I'm looking at it. It looks great. Did you see it, Victoria?
I did. We're going to expand it to jigsaw puzzles, I think. Maybe like radio flyer wagons.
I want spoilers ahoy.
we're working
ding.
On that.
You saw the email. Ding, ding. Yeah, I saw it. It was great.
But thank you. Our clumsy like plugging. This is us something. Plugging our show. Super professional.
And we should all do a movie night. And then we should all go rent the Elysian, do a panel.
Yeah.
All four of us. And then and then have a live Q&A. I'm super serial.
You gotta put it out there. No.
Super serial.
Yeah.
Let's manifest it.
Great. Well, next week.
Thank you both.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for coming. It's been a joy to have you. Next week, Jackie and I will be covering The Third Man, the Carol Reed film with Orson Welles.
You've seen that.
I have.
Yeah. Great Ferris wheel scene. I love Joseph Cotton.
Oh, God. God.
He's so hot.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Sorry.
Come out. No,
I think Joseph Cotton could get it.
We spent, I spent the majority of Great Magnificent Ambersons gushing over him. And our Citizen Kane episode. Yeah.
I listened to that Magnificent Ambersons one. That was great.
Yeah.
Incomplete movies.
Well, come back next week. We're doing Third Man. Until then, I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Seen and Heard is an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club, featuring Greg Kleinschmidt and Jacqueline Postagian. Theme music by Andrew Cox. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. If you have any questions, comments, or you just want to say hi, email us hello@seenandheardpod.com or visit our website, www.seenandheardpod.com.